When the lows of bipolar depression feel dark, Caplyta is a chance to let in the light. Caplyta, lumateperone, is available by prescription only and can be taken alone or with lithium or valproate. Unlike some medicines that only treat bipolar 1, Caplyta is proven to deliver significant symptom relief from both bipolar 1 and 2 depression. And in clinical trials, movement disorders and weight gain were not common.
Caplyta can cause serious side effects. Call your doctor about sudden mood changes, behaviors, or suicidal thoughts right away. Antidepressants may increase these risks in young adults. Elderly dementia patients have increased risk of death or stroke. Caplyta is not approved for dementia-related psychosis or for people under 18. Report fever, stiff muscles, or confusion, which may be life-threatening, or uncontrollable muscle movements, which may be permanent. High cholesterol and weight gain may occur, as can high blood sugar, which may be fatal. Monitoring is recommended. These aren't all the serious side effects. Most common side effects include sleepiness, dizziness, nausea, and dry mouth.
Ask your doctor about Caplyta. Visit Caplyta.com or call 888-252-4824.
With so many options, why choose Arizona State University?
For me, the only online option was ASU because of the quality. Their faculty was really involved with their students and care about your personal journey. The dedication to my personal development from my professors, that's been extremely valuable to me.
Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university online. That's a degree better. Explore more than 300 undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to a special bonus episode of the Ricochet Podcast. It's Steve Hayward sitting in James Lilac's host chair, joined today by Peter Robinson with a very special guest that we are delighted to have with us. Ken Kachigian is joining us for the full hour of the show. Ken has a wonderful new memoir out I highly recommend called Behind Closed Doors, In the Room with Reagan and Nixon. And Ken started in politics way back in the 1960s. I'll get a couple of questions for him about how that went. Worked for Richard Nixon in the Nixon White House, and then followed Nixon out to California after his resignation in 1974, whereupon Ken went on to develop his own very successful law practice, which he kept going while being called back into service at crucial moments by President Reagan. And therein lies a great story. Ken, I want to say welcome to the Ricochet Podcast, and I guess my opening question is this. One of the things I love about your memoir is that after all this time, it gives us some fresh perspective on some old questions, and in light of some recent events, it makes us think differently about some aspects of the Nixon years and the Reagan years. But I guess the first question is, what took you so long? I would have loved to have seen this from you a long time ago. What made you finally decide that the time was now for your memoir of things?
Steve, I get asked that a lot. And it's a really easy answer, and that is I had to make a living in the meantime.
Oh, right.
I had my law practice, and people forget that besides my law practice and writing speeches in the interim for the presidents, I ran campaigns out here in California for Governor Duke Majan and
right.
Wilson and Dan Lundgren, and I did two school choice campaigns out here in California, and Carly Fiorina and Bob Dole's presidential campaign. So I was really busy with a lot of other things, and I just didn't have time, and plus trying to put food on the table. And it was interesting. In my mind, I knew I had to write this book at some point because I had so much to talk about. And as you've both written books, so you know what you have to do. You have to start with the first word. You have to, that blank page is that daunting thing sits in front of you that drives you crazy. What's that first word going to be, and how are you going to open it up? And we were on a cruise off the coast of Italy, and I got bored going into these villages or listening somebody patter away about some ancient thing. And I said, I'm going to stay on the boat and have a cappuccino and smoke a cigar, and opened up a yellow legal pad, and I started writing. But basically, it made sense to wait. First of all, my memoir is rare because I wrote it. I didn't ghostwrite it. So many of my colleagues, Mike Deaver, Larry Speaks, Lynn Nofziger, Ed Meese, and so many others, Jim Baker, they are ghostwritten. And mine is, I wrote it myself. And so it took 4.5 years of research. And one of the benefits of waiting is that I had all the other books and all the other years of passage. Plus, I had the oral histories that were done. So the passage of time was a great benefit for this memoir. And I had the Reagan archives were much more organized.
Right.
So it's a much better book having waited.
Right. Oh, I agree with that entirely. I think we want to go, and I'll toss to Peter in a minute. I think I want to open and keep us in rough chronological order and ask you a couple of questions about the Nixon years. I'll put it this way, pleasantly surprised to read in your book that you were one of the, I guess the phrase that most people would use is one of the diehards defending Nixon to the last and actually counseling him, like our friend Bruce Hershenson and some others, to resist resigning. And, you know, lately I have taken to the work, I think you cite him, of Jeff Shepard and
right.
a few others. We now look back on Watergate, especially in light of the lawfare we've seen recently against President Trump, with a whole new perspective about Watergate. And what's your summation now of how we should think about Watergate? We had large parts of that story wrong all this time.
For sure. And you cite Jeff Shepard, and Jeff has done some extraordinary deep legal and academic research in the last 15 years, and more is going to come in a documentary he's done, but he has uncovered the corruption, and
yeah.
that is not a loose word, mm-hmm. how corrupt Judge Sirica was, and how corrupt the special prosecutor Archibald Cox and Leon Jaworski were, violating the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the Constitution, doing ex parte meetings with the prosecutors. That is that the judge met separately with the prosecutors without defense counsel being present, and rigging the appeals so that they went to the special courts of appeals so that none of Sirica's judgments would be overturned. And so a lot of the special prosecution was rigged in favor of the prosecution all through the process. So what's being uncovered is just extraordinary, Steve. And then one thing that's interesting that I want to write about here somewhere in the next month, if I don't do it, somebody else should, is that the so-called Watergate cover-up is minuscule compared to the cover-up that was taking place over the last two or three years of a president whose mind was diminished.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
You had the Speaker of the House, the Majority Leader of the Senate, you had the Press Secretary of the President of the United States, you had the Secretary of the State, you had the National Security Advisor, all these people covering for a president with cognitive deficiency, holding a nuclear football in his hand, and he couldn't think straight. And that was a cover-up of monstrous capacity that dwarfed Watergate by huge degrees.
Ken, I just have to come in here because there's a question that our viewers are going to want to have asked, and I'm going to ask it. Peggy Noonan put it in her column 2-3 weeks ago that she realized how the Democrats were justifying covering up for Biden. And it was because they all had it in their minds that we had done it first, covering up for Ronald Reagan.
Oh.
Address that, Ken, if you would.
That's insane.
It is.
There was no incapacity. There was no cognitive restriction on President Reagan. Look, I worked with him.
Exactly. This is the point. You're an eyewitness. This is why it's important to hear from you.
I am an eyewitness. And
yes.
Even though I wasn't there full time, I came in at critical moments in 85 and 86 and 87 and 88. I was with him in 88 working on the convention speech that he delivered in New Orleans, and worked with him intensely. He was on point throughout that whole process, and I write about it extensively in the penultimate chapter of my book about how he and Mrs. Reagan went back and forth about how the speech should look like, and then how he edited it. And I didn't see any deficiency in his mind until 4 years later in 1992.
Right.
Was the first time I ever saw him lag, and that's when the first time I bumped into him at a fundraiser, and it's the first time he didn't instantly recognize my face. But that was 4 years after he left the presidency, and 2 years before he recognized that he had Alzheimer's.
Well, and after he'd taken a serious fall from a horse, that gave him a concussion.
Right. I just wanted to bring this out because it's on people's minds,
sure.
And it is a matter of record eyewitness testimony that Ronald Reagan had full cognitive capacity
absolutely
throughout his presidency, to the last day. I just wanted to get that on the record from Ken.
No, absolutely. Now, look, I had personal interaction with him. Peggy did not have the same kind of interaction with him that I did. That's one of the great myths, is that Peggy had a bond with him that, that she had a lot of interaction, that she had a special relationship with him. And look, she's a creative and good writer, but she did not have the same kind of relationship that I did. And I had the times that I worked with him, I had very strong personal interaction with him. He and I had a special relationship. And that means that we worked closely together. We interacted closely together. That means I saw him close up and we edited back and forth. So I can attest to that personally.
With so many options, why choose Arizona State University?
For me, the only online option was ASU because of the quality. Their faculty was really involved with their students and care about your personal journey. The dedication to my personal development from my professors, that's been extremely valuable to me.
Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university. Online, that's a degree better. Explore more than 300 undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
Keep your Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, and Fiat vehicles running strong with B-Pro Auto Parts. Available at your local Mopar Express Lane. Ask for B-Pro Auto.
B-Pro Auto Parts.
Well, I think, I want to hold that point for further elaboration. I want to ask one more revisionist question from the Nixon, that stems back to the Nixon years, and then turn Peter loose on you, and you two speechwriters can draw some things out. It's important. I think you got your start with Nixon through Pat Buchanan and working for Pat Buchanan. And like the Watergate story, I look back now on Pat Buchanan and say, boy, hasn't he been vindicated in a lot of ways, in the way American politics has gone, what people think about national identity questions, immigration, foreign policy to a very large extent, and whether or not you say that you think that Trump is an epigon of Buchanan or Buchananism, say a little bit about Pat Buchanan and whether you think my proposition that he's been vindicated here in recent years is correct.
Pat recognized the new majority before there was a new majority. Wrote about this going back into the 70s and 80s. If you get into the archives and read Pat's memos from the Nixon administration written in the late 60s and early 70s, he recognized the rising Republican majority. Of course, this goes back to ancient political history that some of us remember when Dick Scammon and Ben Wattenberg wrote the book, The Real Majority, recognizing how the working men and women in America who were Democrats had risen up against the elitism of the Democratic Party. And Pat recognized this immediately and was writing memos to President Nixon about this. And then later on, as we were approaching the 72 campaign, was urging President Nixon to recognize this as well. And then later on, he started publishing books about this. And then, of course, he ran his campaign for president on these premises when he challenged George Bush for the presidency. So Pat has indeed been vindicated. Pat was, as I recognize in my book, Pat was my mentor in politics and at the White House, and I still recognize that to this day. The man is absolutely brilliant, by the way. He's one of the most prolific writers. And if you ever want to be edited by Pat, anytime I put anything in front of him, the minute he saw it, he started editing it. So it was sort of scary.
Yeah. Ken, I'm trying to think how we can give a flavor for the book, which is a large piece of work. It's not some sort of slight memoir. It's a large, serious piece of work. You quote from diaries, contemporaneous documents again and again. So how do we give a flavor of that to our listeners in a conversation? And here's a question that might be a way of getting into it. I think of my own experience where I worked for George H.W. Bush first when he was vice president and then for President Nixon. So in my mind, I have this contrast between the two men that in some ways helped me to understand both of them better. How do you think of Richard Nixon? What are the ways in which Nixon and Reagan, the substantive ways in which they differed, and what did those two men nevertheless have in common? They respected each other, although they were such different kinds of men. Why?
Well, they differed in the sense that Nixon was, every waking moment, he thought politically. Everything had a political equation to it. And I don't think Reagan thought that way. Reagan, his political mind was more philosophical, mm-hmm. and was focused on the philosophy of politics and more as a political crusader. And Nixon thought more about the tactics and the strategy of politics. And because Nixon began as a congressional candidate and then as a Senate candidate and then had to defend himself against the establishment, the elite establishment, he had to fight and scrap his way through the political world. And then he campaigned across the country for more candidates. And so I think Nixon really engaged himself day to day more in that kind of political thinking, whereas Reagan didn't wake up in the morning thinking, what some congressional district in Ohio would look like in the next campaign. Or let me put it another way. If you sat down with Nixon and started chatting about politics, he started telling you a story about Charlie Halleck in Indiana and some good story about him, or about what Carl Mundt would do in South Dakota about treating some issue, or what Milton Young, how he campaigned in North Dakota, or what Tom Dewey told him about some mistake he made in the campaign, or then he'd start reflecting upon, Ken, if I had put Thurston Moorton in my ticket in 1960, I might have won the presidency. I don't think Reagan would ever think that way. You'd sit down with him and he'd say, I really got bothered by the way they taxed me back in when I was an actor in the 1950s. And they got me to those 90% taxes. And I worked so hard and they took those taxes away from me. And then, when I went on that speaking circuit, I was an MC at a program where they were giving awards at a bake-off. It was the Pillsbury Bake-Off, and who could provide the best recipe. And this lady won this award, and they handed her a check for, it was like something like $10,000. And, right off stage, there was an IRS agent waiting to collect the tax money from her. And he viewed it as somebody, as them taking away all her incentive for having done something creative.
Right.
So I don't know. It's just the minds thinking so differently. And yet they were both great communicators, but they communicated in different ways as well.
The two of you, I'll be very brief here. This is Ken's show, not mine. But I'll tell a story that gets to your point about Reagan that I think the two of you will get a kick out of. I went to visit him down in the Fox Tower the year after he left office. And I knew I was going to see him that day, so I paid special attention to the newspaper. The LA Times had three anti-Reagan stories on the front page. Saw risk of impeachment, Meese says. Star Wars oversold, Cheney says. There was a third anti-Reagan headline. I get in there, Mr. President, and Ronald Reagan, the first thing he says was, "Did you see the paper this morning?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I did." I thought, brace myself. And he said, "Well, I just don't understand how the judge can decide the outcome of a sporting event." And I thought, what the hell is he talking? And he kept talking, and I realized he wasn't talking about the front page. He was talking about the sporting page, because a judge had just awarded the America's Cup to a cat. They ruled the New Zealand entry was illegal because it was a catamaran, something like that. He hadn't even looked at the front page. He didn't care. And he said, "Well, at least it wasn't a judge I appointed."
Right. That was him, right?
That was Reagan. He quit. So Ken, here's what strikes me, old speechwriter. Nixon and Reagan were both writers. Nixon was more obviously intellectual. This is one of the things that people don't know about Reagan, but that comes through in your book so well. He cared about the text. Mm-hmm. He worked hard on it. And I don't quite know how to put it, but I've always felt that no human being really knows what he thinks until he's put it in words himself.
Mm-hmm.
And both of these men, all their lives, they approached politics differently, but all their lives, they submitted themselves to the discipline of writing. They used us writers, of course, but they used us as extensions in some ways of their own minds. And so I always had the feeling, you would know this, I never even met Richard Nixon, and you knew Ronald Reagan far better than a junior guy like I ever would. But I always had the feeling that they respected each other as men who were standing on the ground, who had reached firm conclusions. And that always struck me. And then the other thing that always struck me was that although they both moved in elite worlds, and the Republican Party in those days still had an Eastern establishment wing, which of course you know in detail, that tortured Richard Nixon, they both came from working backgrounds.
Yeah.
And they understood that about each other too, I felt. Does that sound right to you?
People don't understand how similar their backgrounds were. By the way, they both were rooted in the Midwest originally. Yeah. Nixon's family originally came out from the Midwest, and of course Reagan was came out from the Midwest, and they both came out from very sort of impoverished roots, and both. Made their way out on their own, and Nixon, as he said, you know, they in law school they called him Nixon had an iron butt. He studied very hard and worked very hard, and it was very intellectual in that sense. And you're right, both of them used their writers as extensions of themselves. Nixon liked to work on his own speeches and edit. He edited heavily his own memoirs. He liked the nuance of words. He admired Reagan a lot for his ability to tell stories. And yes. That's I mentioned that in the book quite a bit. And he told me that all the time. He says, Reagan is so good at telling stories. Kenny says, look at Reagan. He's always observing about colors and about scenes, and he's always looking at things and graphically. That makes him such a good communicator. And that's how I learned about when I worked for Reagan. I learned a lot about how Nixon observed Reagan.
Mm.
And I think Nixon admired that of Reagan, and he wished he could do it as well as Reagan, and he tried to do it. And what's interesting about both of them, by the way, neither one of them used teleprompters when they spoke. I hope you noticed that in campaigns. Nixon spoke extemporaneously all the time. Mm-hmm. He never used teleprompters at all in his campaign. He didn't even speak from notes. Now, Reagan used notes, but he never used teleprompters. If you go back and look at Reagan's inaugural address in 1981, he didn't use a teleprompter. Mike Deaver talked him out of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, and what was Deaver getting at there? What Deaver just knew he would be better at doing it?
Mentioned it in the book, and I said, I don't even know what Deaver was talking about, but Deaver said to him, said, Governor, I think you lose yourself in the teleprompter. Now, I don't know what the hell he meant by that. But Deaver seemed to know Reagan.
Yes.
And whatever he meant by you seem to lose yourself in the teleprompter. So Reagan agreed with that. And so he decided just to speak from his half sheets, his famous half sheets.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And if you watch his inaugural address, he doesn't use the teleprompter. And as a result, he doesn't have that phony look about himself where his head is bobbing and bobbing and bobbing back and forth like all the other presidents do now. If you watch Obama give a speech, his head bobs back and forth like crazy. Yep. It's weird.
Like you're watching a tennis match, practically. Yeah.
Yeah, you're watching a tennis match. Yeah, they use these teleprompters, and it's so obvious. And then you see the glass reflection. If it's a bad day, the sun reflects off the teleprompter.
Yeah. Now, Ken, I think you're being too modest in a couple of ways, or Peter hasn't done you full justice. I can criticize Peter instead. So first of all, I mean, you already hinted at the fact that, you mentioned most everybody else, cabinet members. They have their memoirs ghost written. I think that's virtually true of everybody. That yours is not. It's obviously an original work and quoting from your diary and so forth. And so it has a style that's so engaging. But the second point is it makes some real news. I mean, new news, as you might say these days, and especially on this question of Nixon. Now, I know that, you know, Nixon and Reagan knew each other. Reagan mentions in his diary several places, oh, Dick Nixon had a great idea, he told me, about arms control or some other thing. And so, you know, you knew they communicate with each other. What I did not know until your memoir is that you were, especially the campaign in 1980, the go-between between the two of them, quite extensively. And of course, you do mention very candidly that needed to be concealed a little bit because of all the, you know, political baggage of Nixon, and it would be used to attack Reagan and so forth. But I think you should say a little more about that for listeners, because you don't find this, I don't think, in any other account that I've read. How extensive was Nixon following it day by day and communicating with you, communicating through you to Reagan and vice versa? And how did that begin? Maybe that's a good way to start. How did that start?
You know what, Steve, you know what's fascinating about this? Nixon went nuts in 1976 when Reagan was running for president, because he and I sat down in San Clemente, and we would watch the camp. I was his political eyes and ears, so I would go in every day with all the clips and the background and watching television and tell him what was going on with the Reagan campaign. And I was in touch with David Keene and Marty Anderson and Lynn Offsager. They would tell me stories from the campaign, and Nixon would look at Reagan and say, this was going right, this was going well, or he's making this mistake. But it was driving him nuts that he couldn't pick up the phone and call Reagan. He couldn't give him advice. And Nixon was such a great strategist, and that he was dying to give Reagan direct advice in that 76 campaign. Now, it's not necessarily that he wanted him to beat Ford or anything else, but he saw that Reagan had such raw talent, and he wanted to mold him like a piece of clay. And he was frustrated. And then when Reagan put Schweiker on the ticket, it just, Nixon's brain exploded at what a stupid mistake that was. So I'm going back only to say that, so now 1980 rolls around, and here it is, Nixon's protege, me, ends up on the campaign plane with Reagan, and Nixon's not stupid. He's, oh, here's a rare opportunity. I've got a mole in the Reagan campaign, and I can now give advice. And so he starts with phone calls, and then next thing you know, he's got Nick Rui, who was a former Nixon advance man and now chief of staff to Nixon. Nick calls me up, and he says, look, I've got some memo. He says, the old man, or the boss, those days we call him the boss. He says, can you meet with me? And we have this secret meeting. It's like a KGB agent meeting with the CIA in Kansas City. And I gave him a code name, Mr. Hudson. And we meet two blocks away from the hotel, because there's Watergate baggage with Nixon that we're worried about. And Nixon writes this long memo that for the first time I reveal in the book. So we're going back from 76 to 80. Now Nixon can finally advise Reagan. And you know what he's advising him? And it's stick to the economy and don't talk about foreign policy. And then he's giving advice about and then does a second memo about how to do the debate with Jimmy Carter. And in the meantime, he's calling me in different places on the road. And this is so gratifying to Nixon at the time. Now, I don't know the extent to which Reagan took all the advice, but this gave Nixon such gratification that he was, for now, he was back engaged in politics. And I did think at the end of the day, because the advice was going through Stu Spencer, and Stu, just to give you another little twist of history, Stu Spencer's dad was on the original Committee of 100 that recruited Nixon to run for Congress in 1946.
I never heard. Oh, I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. That was Ken Spencer, right? Wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah. My dad knew Ken Spencer pretty well from Republican
politics. Yeah. Ken Spencer was on the Committee of 100 that recruited. So,
Peter, you learned something every day.
I had no idea.
Stu respected Nixon a lot, and so Stu would take these memos and give them to Reagan. I would give the memos to Stu. Stu would give them to Reagan.
Keep your Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, and Fiat vehicles running strong with B-Pro Auto Parts. Available at your local Mopar Express Lane. Ask for B-Pro Auto.
B-Pro Auto Parts.
So there's one other aspect where you're being too modest, Ken, and Peter also kind of picked up on it, but I really want to make this explicit for listeners. It struck me as I was reading the book and also remembering from the history of the time and my own research over the years, how often you were brought in by Reagan at key moments of crisis, like after the first debate in 84 when he performed badly, for certain other key speeches. I'm not aware of many other presidents that had an outside advisor with their own private life and own life going on the way you did. And one of the things that becomes clear in the book, and as I say, you're too modest to boast about it, and I totally get that and respect it, but that you immediately had a bond and a great trust with Reagan and Nancy Reagan in particular. You know, you do mention it in there. You're very candid about how times she was sharp with you, as she could be with everybody when she was mad about something going wrong, or she thought. But the subtext is very clear there that that Reagan had you, maybe not a pedestal is exactly right, but how do you explain that? I mean, were you conscious of this at the time, how unusual this was? And what's your explanation for that?
I think my explanation for that is that it started with the 80 campaign, and it took a while for us to sort of create a relationship together, but I think he liked that by the end of the campaign I was giving him good, I gave him some good lines. I was a good script writer, and he appreciated good script writers. And so by the end of the campaign I had given him some good zingers, and so he said, here, I've got a pretty good guy that knows how to give me some zingers. And then I had helped edit his last 30-minute speeches and gave him some good lines there. And so I was one person he was familiar with. I was a face that he knew. He was comfortable. So I created a comfort zone. And then I worked with him, of course, on the inaugural address and then the first few days. Then what I would ascribe it to, Steve, is that I didn't fight with him. I didn't argue with him about, Mr. President, no, I don't like the way you're phrasing this. Here's what you should say. This is what the way you should do it. I think there are a lot of people, and I know later in the presidency, a lot of his writers would try to tell him what to say or put policy in his head. I don't want to name names, but...
Well, Peter would be one of them, but no, I'm kidding.
Well, I think Tony Dolan was one that was always trying to make policy with this, would meet with him and try to, and certainly Darman and Baker sort of implicitly or explicitly tried to make policy. But I didn't argue with him. I did what he wanted. I never thought nobody elected me to anything. So I worked with him, and if I thought there was a way to make a phrase better, I would suggest, maybe we can do it this way. But I didn't fight with him because I thought he was a good writer. So he felt comfortable. That made him comfortable.
Right. Well, one of the lines in your book that really jumps out at me was you're quoting Nancy saying, Ronnie, Ken's idea is good. You should listen to him. I don't know how often she may have said that, but that strikes me as very
significant. You know where that came from? It came from my education with Nixon. And I tell people I got my PhD at the University of Reagan, but I got my bachelor's and master's at the College of Richard Nixon. And you can't spend 4.5 years in the Nixon White House and 4 years in San Clemente with Nixon without learning good politics and good phraseology and good communications. And so what we were talking about in that particular occasion was an interview with Barbara Walters and how to shape a message. And during Watergate and dealing with the Vietnam War and dealing with all the controversies that we had during the Nixon administration, you learned how to shape a message. And so when we got into any situation where Reagan had to give an answer to a question, I think I was in a better position than most people on his staff because I had already had about 6, 7, 8 years of experience dealing with a lot of high-level troublesome situations than any of his other staff people. And that was Ken, that came from Nixon.
How did you get I was about to say, how did you handle Nancy Reagan? That is the wrong way to phrase that question. But how did you get, did she make up her mind about you quickly that you were all right?
As long as he was happy with me, she was happy with me.
Got it.
It was always reflective of his relationship with me. There were some exceptions. She was not happy with me when I wouldn't come back full time. That was, we were at Camp David in June of 1981 when I was called back on a special situation after I had left the White House and I refused to leave my family to come back full time. And she was angry because Ronnie wanted me back and Ronnie needed me and he was unhappy with me. But generally, if the president was happy with me, she was happy with me. But if she thought that I wasn't serving him well, she would get unhappy. And there was that confrontation on Air Force One after the first debate, or just prior to the first debate, where she thought I wasn't serving him well, and she thought I was to blame. She went after me, even though it wasn't my fault. So we had a little tiff. The blame was on Jim Baker, not me. So it depended on the situation.
But this is also very important for the record that an eyewitness, a man who knew them both well, and there are not many left, and there were never many who knew both the president and Mrs. Reagan well, that Mrs. Reagan's concern was her husband.
Right.
Not policy.
Right.
Not her own fame. We're not talking about a Hillary Clinton who wanted her own career.
Right.
If you were serving her husband, you were all right with her.
Exactly. Yeah.
Correct?
Right.
Yeah.
And yeah. Except there was one exception, and that was in that I think I sort of diplomatically deal with regard to at the end of the 1988 convention speech. And she wanted it a different way than he wanted it. And I got caught in the middle at the very end. It's reflected in the lunch we had at the ranch. And if you read between the lines in the conversation that I kept my notes, I always kept my notes very, it was hard to eat the shrimp salad and take notes and listen to the president and first lady not getting along with each other on how a speech should be written. She wanted it one way and he wanted it another way. And I felt that if the president wanted it his way, that he should get it his way. And she wanted it a different way. And in the end, because he got it his way and not her way, I think she was unhappy with me.
Lynn Novziger told me this story that, Lynn, you probably know this. Excuse me. The question here is, what happened when the two of them disagreed? And Lynn told me the story that she called him. This is 76. Reagan's been losing. They're now in North Carolina. Mrs. Reagan calls Lynn up to the suite. The president or the then former governor is not there. It's just the two of them. And it becomes clear, she starts in on Lynn. It becomes clear that it is her idea that it's up to Lynn to talk Reagan into dropping out of the presidential race. And Lynn said, you know, as we know, she was a force of nature. And all of a sudden, the door opens and Reagan walks into the suite unexpectedly. Whereupon Lynn and Mrs. Reagan both fall silent and just look at him. And Lynn said somehow Reagan knew immediately what they had been talking about. And Reagan looked at both of them and said, I don't care what she says, I'm staying in the race. Well, so when it came to it, he tended to get his way.
Well, there is one other scene in the book that I described where I was extremely uncomfortable, where in the 1987 State of the Union, we're looking at the very final draft.
1987, okay, right. This is when Don Regan lost control, right?
Right.
Okay.
I've delivered the final draft. I guess we're in the residence, and I don't have the book in front of me, but I describe it in the book very distinctly. And he says, okay, it looks like we're pretty much done here. He said, but Ken, we don't have a reference here to the right to life, and I'm a little troubled by that. And don't you think we ought to insert something in here about protecting the life of the unborn? And Mrs. Reagan is standing behind him, and I'm looking at her over his shoulder, and she's shaking her head furiously, no, 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 and mouthing the words, no. And I say to him, and I sort of stutter, going, well, Mr. President, then I say, well, I think you've said it, and there we go. Well, but our friends, you know, they're upset when I don't put that in speeches. And she's still shaking her head furiously. Okay, so he's arguing to put it back in, and if I go with him, she's going to put a stiletto in me that goes from stomach to back, and, you know, I'll never be seen again. And so I finally come up with this line that where I sort of a gutless line where I say, well, you know, you've made your point so many times, Mr. President, I think they'll forgive you this one time for not putting it in. And it was sort of a cowardly exit on my part.
But in the facing certain death.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It would have meant probably not serving him again. So I don't know.
I don't know if that's such a bad moment for you, Ken. I mean, remember that, I'm sure you do remember, that Reagan was the first sitting president to publish a book while in office, and it was his book some months before the campaign on abortion and the conscience of a nation. And as you probably know, there was a huge fight among Reagan's political staff about him publishing that book. And at the end of the day, he said, I want to do it. So anyway, I think you were right. In other words, I think the line you made was substantively correct, even if it was an awkward and difficult moment. Anyway, Peter, you've got a couple more.
No, I had a pro-life passage in a speech that we got into a meeting in the Oval Office, and Darman and Baker were there, and they both tried to talk him out of it. And Reagan just listened and smiled, and then the president stood up and went to his desk and said, by the way, I just received a letter from some medical doctors telling me about that fetuses can feel pain earlier than we understood. And this is Reagan. He read this passage signed by six medical doctors as if it was just interesting to him. And then he walked back to his chair, and on the way to his chair, he dropped the letter in Darman's lap and said, I think we should put that in the speech too. My goodness, Baker and Darman went white as sheets with fury, but of course they controlled themselves. He felt strongly on that one.
Yeah.
So Ken, here's the question of the hour. Richard Nixon gets dealt a very bad hand. Vietnam,
right?
The erosion of our position in the Cold War, stagnant economy, an establishment that was against him. But by the end of the administration, the economy's beginning to turn around. We're finally out of Vietnam. Reagan comes in, and the 70s are put behind us, and we get a national renewal. I mean, I'm just so struck. I think about this often, that 79, we're in such a weak position that the Soviets feel free to go into Afghanistan and the Iranians feel free to take Americans hostage. And 89, this is just 10 years later. There's been such an American renewal that it spills over into the rest of the world and the Berlin Wall comes down. There are a lot of Americans who have their hopes up this time. Are we in a position for another national renewal? Are the predicates, the political predicates, the will of the people, the political system, or is this more likely to be Donald Trump just holding the line as best he can, holding things together, which I take to have been Richard Nixon's gift to the nation? He held things together in a very difficult time. What's the correct parallel? What do you expect?
Well, the benefit Reagan had was he had an adversarial press, but not an enormously adversarial press. He entered the presidency with a pretty balanced media, and it got tougher as he went, and it got tougher, especially during the Bitburg controversy. They went after him, and then during Iran-Contra. But when he started with the economic recovery in 81, and the defense buildup, he wasn't confronted with the massive adversarial press that Nixon had in 1969, when Nixon was dealing with the Vietnam War. Trump's issue is that he's going to have an adversarial press from January 21st, day one. So Trump's going to be faced with a lot of the same problems Nixon had. Now, what Trump has going for his favor that Nixon did not have, and I mentioned this in all my presentations, is that Nixon never had a Congress going for him.
Right.
Nixon had the Congress in the hands of the Democrats for the entire 5.5 years of his presidency. When you see what Nixon accomplished during his presidency with Democrats in charge of the Senate and the House, the absolute entire time Nixon was in office, he still got a lot of things done. Trump has the advantage of having the Senate and the House for at least first 2 years of his presidency. If he's very clever and very careful, then I think he can, what you're saying is potentially possible. And he has to, he can't squander that advantage. If he squanders that advantage by behavior that goes overboard, or by not being presidential, by not using his powers wisely, then he'll lose the ability that he has. But he has that potential going for him because that's an ability that he has to take. And Reagan only had a Senate going for him in the first part of his presidency. So, and Trump, I will say this about Trump. He knows how to use the bully pulpit. He really does. I think
he's to be a bully, but you're anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
He does know how to use it. And, but if he uses it, but he can, he also has the ability to squander it away, and he has to be very careful. And I do think one thing he's doing wisely is he's bringing loyalty into the equation on his staffing. And I'm not quite sure everything he's doing in terms of his appointments is wise, but within his internal staffing, I think he's making wise decisions.
Keep your Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, and Fiat vehicles running strong with B Pro Auto Parts, available at your local Mopar Express Lane. Ask for B Pro Auto.
B Pro Auto Parts.
You know, there's the Peter's question. Your answer reminds me of the apocryphal Mark Twain line that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And so in the last couple of weeks, when Trump has been going on about the Panama Canal, maybe we ought to get it back, I kind of wish his next sentence would be, because Ronald Reagan was right about it after all. But beyond that, I mean, some of his things now that are, you know, either outrageous or amusing or some deliberate combination, like the Gulf of America instead of Gulf of Mexico, and, you know, we want Greenland. Never mind what those are, may really be about or not. But underneath that, the subtext to me is very Reagan-esque, but in Trumpian bombast. In other words, he's really trying to turn the page and reverse this, what you might call a little America. Again, it's an echo, a distorted echo of Jimmy Carter's age of decline and malaise that we've been having the last several years. And so in that respect, although the personalities are so different and rhetorical styles and, you know, as you say, his own character, which is erratic, I do see some Reagan-esque parallels there. I don't know, is that reasonable, or is that Peter thinks it's reasonable, I think. Go ahead, Peter. Go through with your last question.
Ken, this is just occurring to me, but it's almost mandatory in light of what's happened the last few days. So if the rest of the country would like to tune out, Ken and Steve and I have something in common with both Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, and that is we can't help ourselves. We love California. So California meant an enormous amount to both of those men. It's Nixon grew up here. He couldn't help himself from returning to California. He was always felt drawn like a moth to a flame to New York and to the power structures and the Eastern establishment, but he was always most at home out here in California. And of course, Reagan loved the place. It was where everything good happened to him. I once heard him say, you may have heard him say it a dozen times, I think I only caught it once, is he said, if the pilgrims had landed in California instead of back east, nobody would have bothered to discover the rest of the country.
Right, yes, right.
All right. So Pete Wilson, I can't remember the year in which Pete left office, but Pete was the last of two things. He was the last real Republican governor, which means I'm not counting Arnold Schwarzenegger. We can argue about that if anybody wants to argue, but that man was no Republican when it came to it. And he was also the last competent governor.
Right.
Pete was competent in politics. He had that Nixon element in him.
Right.
But he was competent as a governor. He got the state government to do what it ought to do, to treat citizens well, to permit economic growth to take place.
And recover from big disasters. Let's keep that right now.
And recover from big disasters. So what I'm wondering is there hope for California? Can these unbelievable catastrophe, as we record this, these fires are still raging, and as far as I can, I just checked the news, they think they have the Pacific Palisades fire controlled by 2%. These things are still out of control. Are Californians going to finally demand competent governance again? Lord, is there even an opening for some rebirth of the Republican? How can it be that the most beautiful, talented, magnificent state in the country can be so messed up for so long?
I've been thinking about this all day, and of course it's not just the governor. I watched the speaker responding to questions. I was watching on Twitter, on X today, responding to questions. I mean, the man is an idiot. Rivas, is that his name?
The Speaker of the Assembly?
Yeah. He couldn't get a declarative sentence out. And so the entire legislature is an autocracy that doesn't know what it's doing. And so the entire state is being governed irresponsibly. But who's voting them in? It's the people whose houses, the 6,000 houses that have been raised, my guess is two-thirds of them voted for these people in office.
Two-thirds, and 10% of them gave a lot of money. These are rich. These are the rich Californians we're talking about here.
Exactly, and concerned about the fire hydrants that didn't have water, and probably have given money to the Environmental Defense Fund. So by the way, a lot of these problems don't just rest on Gavin Newsom. They go back to Jerry Brown. People forget this all began with Jerry Brown. And somebody was talking or writing about the Train to Nowhere. John Heibusch in his Substack this morning that I read, was talking about the Train to Nowhere. That began with Jerry Brown. It didn't begin with Governor Newsom. And the high tax rate of 13+%, that was a proposal by Jerry Brown, not by the legislature or by Gavin Newsom. That began with Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown is the progenitor of all these problems, and nobody's pointing the finger at him. So, yes, there's hope if the people look within themselves, but it has to do with the leadership in the state. The business community has to turn its back against funding a lot of this. But do you think the editorialists at the LA Times? I'm glad that this man who bought the is it Patrick is his name?
I can't pronounce the name, Doctor.
Yeah, I can't either write
his last name, but who's bought the LA Times. Maybe he'll turn it around, but I don't think their writers or anybody else is going to change, and maybe some of their houses have burned down, but they don't even think about these things. It's unless that changes, nothing's going to change, but it really is sad. The state that I grew up in and the wonderful, beautiful state that it is. Unless people...
I don't understand how the Armenians could have let this happen.
Well, George Dukmajian, I can guarantee that none of this would have happened under George.
No, of course not. Of course not.
A great government. By the way, you talked about an era of national renewal. That was one of the themes of, I don't know if you actually did that on purpose. That was the theme of President Reagan's 1981 inaugural address.
Right. That you were the first draft writer to organize his thoughts and then handed it off to him.
Right. It was the era of national renewal. He called for an era of national renewal. I would just say one last thing about Trump's chances here in his first 2 years, whether it's Greenland, Panama Canal, all those other things, unless he focuses on the economy, he'll be making a big mistake. He's got to get the economy back on track.
Yeah, so Nixon was right again. Ken, we have barely scratched the surface of what you revealed in Behind Closed Doors, but thank you for opening some of those doors. I think we'll want to have you back when you do some more work on Watergate and you know the revisions going on with that. But in the meantime, thanks for spending an hour with us. Congratulations on Behind Closed Doors. Peter, glad you could surface once in a while to join Ricochet again.
The mystery man. Listen, that's the only thing I ever get asked on. I've made 102 radio interviews, podcasts, TV interviews, and 20 book presentations. You know what the question I always get asked? Did you write Tear Down This Wall?
Oh, jeepers.
One of these days, I'm going to take credit for that damn speech.
Well, you see, that's right. Yeah, Peter doesn't deserve it.
That's all I ever get asked.
Isn't that interesting?
But I do. Well, I give credit where credit is due.
You know, okay, so Steve, we're getting notes here from our producer who wants to break for lunch or something. But I do, so you touch on that. I'm not going to go through this whole story, but it's important. I think you're going to agree with me.
I know what you're going to say, Peter. Go ahead.
I wrote that speech. I would not have written that speech for anybody else than Ronald Reagan. And by that stage, I'd been in Washington long enough to get to know George H.W. Bush, Howard Baker, a number of men who might have been president instead of Reagan, would only have written that for Reagan, and only Reagan would have delivered that. And so it feels to me as though we're speechwriters, but I'm sure you agree, Ken, that over and over again in your work, it's you can hear Reagan in your own mind as you're writing for him. Somehow or other, the speeches that we wrote for that man belonged to him.
Because the man knew stagecraft.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, right.
That's very important. Yeah.
All right, listeners, thanks for joining us. As we always like to say, or James Lydex likes to say, please go to Apple's, iTunes, and other venues and give us a 5-star review. Join us in the comments on Ricochet 4.0, I guess we're calling it, and we will see you back here next week after you have gone to the bookstore and ordered Behind Closed Doors by Ken Kachikian. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Ken, thank you.
Thank you very much. See you both.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.
Keep your Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, and Fiat vehicles running strong with B-Pro Auto Parts. Available at your local Mopar Express lane. Ask for B-Pro Auto.
B-Pro Auto Parts.